Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a full house tonight, both people and guitars. And I'm really proud, and this is something I've been toying about a long time to do, and that is a series of guitar shows talking about a certain aspect, in this case, Gibson guitars. So this is the first of hopefully many, and we're going to try to cover, it's going to take a while, it might take a year or two, I think, because there's that many guitars that Gibson makes, but I'm thinking that we'll be able to cover all of the different guitars. So today we're going to start out with the probably one of the most famous guitars that Gibson made. It's definitely an icon, and it's definitely part of our music history globally and for America, and that's the Archtop guitar, specifically the L5. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, and which led up to, and we're in the next few months, we're going to cover a bunch of different Archtops that Gibson make. And they're just beautiful guitars. I'm dying in here because I'm looking at all these amazing guitars that look great. But let me start off introducing everybody that's here, because the people here are the most important because they know all the stuff. First of all, I want to introduce Sharon DeLordo. She's been on several times. We've done a couple of shows to commemorate Orville Gibson, and what a great way to do that right now, but go through all the guitars that he made. So, Sharon, I want to welcome you.
Thank you.
Also, I want to sitting here with one of the L5s. I think that's a Florentine cutaway. Is Wolf Marshall, and he's a guitarist. He's an educator. Are you still at UCLA in the jazz department?
Yes, I am, Jeff.
So you are okay. I'm from SC, and I won't hold that against you. No, I'm just teasing. So anyway, no, it's really good to have you. Good to have you here, and. He's also an author, and I didn't post on there because he's written so much stuff. Just give us a couple of things that you would recommend people to check out. I know that JP's read some of your stuff.
Yeah.
Well, regarding this subject, probably the best of jazz guitar has a good sampling of all the main jazz guitarists playing comparable tunes, so you mm-hmm. can judge their approaches. That's always been a big seller. And my Wes Montgomery and Kenny Burrell books, Pat Martino, B.B. King, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Clapton.
There's just so many.
Jimi Hendrix.
The Hendrix book, yeah.
Aerosmith.
Okay. No, that's good. So, and I'll give the website in a little bit so you can check out what he's doing. And then also next to him is Greg DeLordo, and another guitar player, another great guitar player. And he brought his beautiful little L5, and he's worked with both the Gibsons and the Heritages from Kalamazoo. Knows the guitars, and he even brought some of the training manuals. They're floating around here on the table. So, Greg, it's always great to have you on the show. You always fascinate me with the stuff that you're doing.
Thank you, Jeff.
Next to him, a new friend of mine that I met through JP. He's been telling me about this guy. you got to see his guitars. He's got great guitars and stuff like that. And he's another L5. He wasn't able to bring his L5 in tonight.
There's no room.
Yeah, that's true. There is no room.
You can only get so many archtops in this room.
James Aker, and he plays in Royal Crown.
No longer Once Upon a Time.
Once upon a time. Awesome. And if you look at some of the YouTube videos, you'll see him playing an L4.
Also, there's some Super 400.
Super 400. Yeah. So he's got some interesting guitars,
currently,
too.
Currently, there's a bunch of stuff at rumproller.com. It's an organ trio that I do.
Oh, very cool.
Guys. It's sort of an organ collective.
Very, very cool.
There, you can find us there, too.
And hiding in the back off camera, you can't see him, as my partner in crime, in terms of he always comes and helps me set up and everything. Doug Moore. He's the lone bass player in all these guitar players. But last but not least, on the telephone, calling from Texas, is another great. He's a doctor, but he's also another guitarist and a collector. And he wrote this book, which I recommend. It is the coolest book I've ever seen. The Gibson Super 400, The Art of the Fine Guitar. Dr. Thomas Van Hoos. Dr. Tom, it's good to have you on the show. Welcome to the show.
Well, welcome to you guys. This is radio station KTXS. and I'm calling in to thank you for including me in what should be a lot of fun this evening.
yes. And all of these guys are experts on these guitars. And I was reading, in this book, even though this book is Tom has written, his focus is on the Super 400, there's a whole chapter, and it's a big chapter, on the L5s, and I was just blown away about all of the different ones, and he's got the specs, how they were made, how you can tell the differences for the collector and the player. But it's just mind-blowing, the history of this. So what I want to start out first, I'm going to direct this to Sharon, is let's just get a little bit of an overview. I'm trying to say Orville. Freudian slip. Sorry, Doc. Don't analyze
him. He's in the room.
He's in the room. That's right. So anyway, what I want to do is just get a little bit of an overview on the development, how the archtop came to be, and a little bit of that, and then we'll get into the more specifics of the guitar.
Thank you for having us. It is always such a pleasure and such a thrill to be here. And one of my favorite subjects, aside from my husband Greg, is the subject of Orville H. Gibson. And he is a man that I think has had too little recognition in history, in guitar history, music history. And if I serve my life purpose, Orville H. Gibson will be what you think of when you hear the word or the name Orville. You won't think popcorn, and you won't think flying. You'll think guitars.
Or the TV show.
that one I don't know. Anyway, Orville was born in 1856, and he died in 1918. He was a great entertainer in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And, as you can only dance and sing on stage for so long, but he had such a keen ear, and music was, he was so much a part of his life, perfect pitch, and so talented. And I think he kind of aged out of the stage performing, but you couldn't take the music out of his soul. So what's the next best thing? Well, also, there's some crossover here, because I believe, and this is just my theory, is that because he was a great mandolin player, guitarist, harp guitarist, and he built all these instruments, maybe part because he didn't have the resources to go out and buy all of these, but he had the knowledge and the technique to build, and so he was building. And such an astute person, such a keen ear, he ended up taking the guitar and patterning the mandolin and the guitar, the harp guitar, several instruments that we won't never know about, after the construction of the violin, because the violin gave such a superior projection in a theater. And you have to think, too, we're talking about 1800s when they didn't have great amplification in movie in the stage theaters. So I think there was a little ego, and that ego, he wanted to be able to be heard above the other instruments that were performing that night. So in 1894, he had been developing his craft well enough where he was confident that he could get a patent for carving the tops and the back. And so by 1903, you know, that patent is granted in 1898, and the first, what we would really think is the precursor to the what we know today as the arch top guitars, the carved tops and back, would be the Orville or the Gibson style O, and it just was a smaller guitar, but the tops and the back were carved out of a single piece of wood. And then that went on, and I do want to say this is the 100th year anniversary since he passed, and I think part of just this gathering of absolutely incredible musicians and the interest in the carved guitar, that is part of his legacy. He did something in the late 1800s that survives today and is greatly loved by many musicians. So by, you know, we had the 1902, the first Gibson catalog that came out when he sold the rights to his patent in his name in 1902, the company, and the company is what most people know about, that they came out with their first catalog in 1903, and there's a picture of the style O. There's like three versions in that. And then the company does some modifications. They take, because that was a paddle head in the beginning, and then the company takes the instrument and they put a scroll in the headstock, and they put a cutaway kind of thing, and said it really looked pretty cool. So it developed, the development of that continued. And then 1923-24, you had Lloyd Lohr, who joined the company. By this time, of course, Orville is passed away, so everyone from, you know, later on is dealing with the company and not Orville directly. Orville was really out of the company by 1905, but he left a body of information and love to the people that were there. And so Lloyd Lohr, in this carved to top and back, it was called the Master Model. And then they, for a year, there was a Sweet 16, and we have a Sweet 16 tribute guitar to Orville Gibson behind Greg over here, which actually has Orville's signature in it. And then by 1934, we have the 17-inch L5 advanced model. And then by 1951, we have the electric ES, CES L5. And then this is where I will pass it on.
Well, let me ask a question, and I'll throw it out to everybody. So the Sweet 16, the 16 is the body size, right?
Yes, it was a 16-inch, and it was a carved top and back. And the term Sweet 16 came up in 1923 with the Lloyd Lohr version of it, which was known. It's the Master Model, but that particular year, it was a Sweet 16, was kind of like also known as. So So in commemoration, we did a Sweet 16 version.
Mm-hmm. Now, the L5s that you guys are holding in your hands right now, what's the size of the body?
A 17-inch advanced style, which are the 17-inch, like I mentioned, but also their CESs because they're electric.
Yeah. Okay, so they're, I'm trying to give an idea to people the scale, because the one behind you,
16-inch.
Mike, just pick it up. James, pick that up and just show it to the camera. So you can see it's a little smaller body. Is a 16-inch the size like of a ES-175?
Yes.
So if those that are familiar with that guitar, it's basically that size guitar.
With a 25.5-inch scale.
Right.
Oh, that's the scale change between the body size?
Well, that's a larger scale.
Yeah, on the Sweet 16, this one, yes.
So, But the okay, so let's go ahead and because one of the things, and Tom mentioned this in his book, I didn't know this, but the L5 was the first F-hole guitar. Am I correct?
Yes, in 1920, Lloyd Lord joined the group. Now, Sharon already mentioned about the Model F and the scroll and the cutaway, and that guitar lasted until 21 in the catalog, and that was, all those features were carried over into the L5 except for the F-holes, and when Lloyd Lord came on board, he added the F-holes to the already existing features and all that guitar had, which would have been the oval fingerboard, these were all firsts, and the angled pitched neck dove joint, the carved top, the elevated pickguard, the elongated tailpiece, the metal tailpiece, and then the adjustable bridge. These are all things that were back in that guitar that got carried over onto Lloyd Lohr's first L5 with F-holes. So these guitars date back all the way to those.
That original one that you're talking about, that type style O, that had a flap type of hole in it.
Yes, an oval hole.
Had an oval hole.
Yes, right, exactly. So so that was the 1920 Lloyd Lohr until 25. Then Lloyd Lohr was no longer with the company, and then that model continued on. And then the next inversion you see is the 34 L5, 17-inch advanced model.
Now, Lloyd, but let me get this straight, because I was looking in Tom's book, and Tom, you can chime in here. As I understand it, the L5 debuted in 1923. Am I correct?
Late 1922, early 23.
Okay, mm-hmm. Correct. So Lloyd Lohr was definitely there at the time of that one was coming that came out.
Absolutely.
And then when did Lloyd leave?
25.
In 1925. Okay, so I get an idea. Was it cosmetic or was there an advantage to the F-hole?
Well, both cosmetically, shaping more towards the violin look, but also it has a sweeter tone. That was one of the reasons they used that term sweet 16, because the F-holes has a much more mellow, much of a more sweet tone. So it kind of became a slang term for that guitar.
So there was a difference in
difference,
that.
Right. Okay. Absolutely.
And then also to go in a little bit of the differences, and I don't know, I'm throwing it out to everybody, so just chime in, don't be shy, the differences of some of the guitars. So I have a little bit of notes here from Tom, and Tom, feel free to put more info here. There was the first, from 1923, the first one was a pre-war 16-inch L5. Then there was a, from 1934 to 1941, there was a 17-inch pre-war L5. And then post-war L5, 1946 to present. And then the electric ones, the post-war L5 CES, 1951 to present. Correct?
That's correct.
Very good. That's in a general sense, you've got the overview of the evolution. Some of the 16-inch guitars carried over until 1937. They were kind of pushing through their orders to finish those up for people. But in general, you've got it covered. That's it.
So what was the different? Were there differences in the construction from a 16-inch to 7-inch besides the size? And because you mentioned things in your book about the necks and the bindings and the headstocks, the inlays. Can you kind of go through a little bit of that? And I know that's a lot to ask.
Sure.
But kind of.
Very, very briefly, the earliest L5s had very large, thick necks. They were X-braced. No. They were parallel braced, and they had a 24 3/4 inch scale, like a Les Paul guitar, basically. As the guitar kept evolving, they went from the parallel bracing to the X bracing. The necks became a little less clubby, a little more comfortable to play. And then when they lengthened the scale to 25 1/2 inch, it really changed the feel of the guitar. It even changed some of the tone of the guitar to some degree.
Okay.
Would you say that the bracing change made a big difference in your opinion?
It's debatable. Some X brace. I mean, the modern day luthiers that make arch tops swear by the X bracing, but some swear by the parallel bracing. It just depends on a lot of factors, including the most important, which is the person playing it.
Always the most important.
I might insert that when we commissioned this Sweet 16, even though it's an acoustic, we did order it with a tap tune top and back with parallel brace to give it that more mellow sound. So there is a more mellow sound with parallel.
And at that time, too, the cutaway didn't come until the electrics, if I'm correct, or did it come before that?
No, it came in 1939. And those were acoustics only at that time, although I had in my personal collection a 39 or 1940 Super 400 with a factory cutaway and a pickup. It was an anomaly, kind of. But they were introduced in 1939, the cutaways.
And that was a Venetian or the Florentine?
The Venetian, the rounded cutaway.
The rounded. Now, did that affect a lot of the sound, or was it pretty close to the other one? That's what I'm curious about. Does the cutaway affect the sound?
Well, you lose some of the body when you do that, of course. And some people would say that the non-cutaways and cutaways do sound different acoustically. But again, there's a lot of variation between individual instruments, especially the old ones. The advantage of the cutaway was you could play further up the neck and play very hard-to-reach chords in the upper register, and there's a number of guitarists that play up there quite effectively, you know.
Now let me throw it out to all you guys here. Have you played anything that have you played the non-cutaway ones?
Oh yeah.
Oh sure.
How do you feel? I mean, well, you played with pickups, but without the pickup acoustically, do you hear a difference?
Well, to me, they all sound great, but every time I play a non-cutaway, I always wish it had a cutaway.
Oh, okay. No, that's true.
That's why we ordered a cutaway.
It does make you play different. Yeah, you know, you definitely play like...
You're limited.
But, yeah, exactly.
Besides the difference in that, the limitation of that, but I mean, is the difference in tone, is it more just from the difference being two different guitars, or is it really a difference for that?
I think it's a non-appreciable difference.
Okay.
I don't think it's a major difference, but could be the guitar.
Wolf, what do you think?
I kind of agree. I actually have both. At one point, I had a Super 300, believe it or not. There was a predecessor to the Super 400. It was called Super 300, which was an unadorned Super 400, kind of a planar neck, rosewood fingerboard, but a big body. Anyway, it was non-cutaway. The other one I had was an L5 1940 non-cutaway, and that guitar remained a stiff guitar for its whole life. Mm. It wasn't played and seasoned. It stayed tight and, for lack of a better word, just unsoulful.
Do you think that's because it wasn't played enough? Or
I think it was not played enough. It was a museum item, and people treated it that way, and so it wasn't treated well.
Yeah.
It was just displayed,
yeah,
so to speak.
Okay. Okay, let me throw it back to Greg. You had mentioned to me before that there was a guitar design. One of the L5s was specifically designed for the for Wes. Can you elaborate a little more?
Well, actually, Tom, I think, is the expert on that particular guitar, because Tom actually was very instrumental in that.
Take away it, Tom.
Well, Wes Montgomery's went through a series of Gibson guitars, and he played an L5 guitar very much like Wolf's guitar that you see with him right now. But he really liked the sound of the single pickup. And he had an acoustic L5 with a cutaway with a little DeArmin pickup that was just mounted kind of resting on the top. And that guitar was the one that was converted to where they built a pickup into the top, and they inlaid a little heart around the cutaway with his name in it. That became the one that we call the Wes Montgomery guitar, and it was associated with him until he died. Gibson was the early 1990s, they were developing a collection called the Historic Collection, and they were reaching back in time through their electric guitars and their acoustic guitars, including archtops, to recreate some of the old designs. And one of them was the Wes Montgomery guitar, and I actually gave them the idea about how to do that. And it was simply to take an L5 electric body and mount one pickup in it instead of two. And to use woods that were a little less figured than the real fancy ones so they could price it lower. And initially that guitar came out in 1993. and they made 85 of them that first year. Most of them were Sunbursts like Wes's. And they were terrific instruments. They were $4,500 retail at that time. And the current L5 at that time with two pickups was almost $8,000. So people gravitated to that guitar pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. So Wes had a guitar originally that had a pickup mounted on the pickguard. And I've seen the Johnny Smith, which is mounted on the pickguard. Was there any attempt to do kind of like what happened with the Johnny Smith on the L5, where you left the soundboard free from the pickup where it wasn't vibrating, or that didn't matter?
Right. That, you know, Gibson offered a pickguard with a pickup in it as an accessory, called the McCarty pickguard, and it had a little P90 pickup in it, and you could buy that and just convert your guitar without disturbing the top. And they offered that for their non-cutaway and cutaway art shops for at least through the 1950s, if not later. So that was their first attempt, and then you could custom order them. My guitar teacher had a 69 L5 acoustic, and he ordered it with the Johnny Smith pickup, so you could order them, you know, special like that as well.
Now, let me throw this out to all you guys, too. Does that a major difference? Now, you're playing guitars with the pickups mounted on the soundboard.
I'd say it's a major difference if you want to play the guitar acoustically like the Johnny Smith was. You know, the guitar is 100% acoustic, so the pickup is not enhancing in any way the top. But once you sink that humbucking into the top, it gives it a distinct tone. It takes away some sustain, and it gives that punch. And that's that tone that Wes had. So there's a distinct tone when you sink the humbucking right into the top.
So putting the humbucker in the sound onto the top, actually you lose sustain?
You lose some sustain, acoustic sustain, but it gives you attack. So you get some punch for it, and that was the tone. And even the rear pickup, Wolf and I were talking about this just tonight, even though the treble pickup may not be used a lot on the guitars, it does dampen the top, gives the guitar a certain tone, even though you're not using that pickup, such as Kenny Burrell's guitar. And Kenny never, I don't think he ever uses that pickup.
Most jazzers, I've never heard very much of the treble in jazz.
Although, since we're on the treble pickup, the L5 was used in My Girl, that guitar line, and that was in the treble pickup only.
It was actually both.
It was a both?
Yeah,
was
both
it?
Pickups. Yeah. The middle position.
Huh. Middle position?
Yeah. It has that quacking sound that you distinctively remember.
Yeah.
It's a certain timbre that really only comes from that. He was one of the main guitar players who played in L5 in the 60s for non-jazz.
Yeah.
There's also Jerry Miller, Moby Grape. Of course.
Well, the Chuck Mangione song, Feel So Good, with
Grant Geisman.
Used an L5, and I'm pretty sure that's the two pickups.
Oh, yeah, it's exactly like this. It's just a 68.
Exactly.
This brings up a question to interject at the moment, because I've just been looking at, this is your L5, correct?
That's got a 59 with the McCarty. Yeah.
A 59 with the McCarty, so there's a pickguard here, and I'm going to send this around. This is very cool. Mm-hmm. So given that, he can talk a little bit about that, but I'm also curious about the evolution of the pickup inside this particular instrument, because you're talking about going from Darmond to Charlie Christian to a P90 to a humbucker? Is that the general?
That sounds
more or less.
Yeah. So the question, the 39 Super 400 that you have, I'm assuming it's a Blade pickup, a Charlie Christian pickup?
Tom?
No, it wasn't. It was a P90 pickup that was slanted at an angle.
So like an ES-300 style, like the long.
Yeah, but not the long one, but a short one. Wow. You know?
Let me see. Is it in the color pictures, that one that you're talking about, Tom?
Yes, it is. Yes,
right, hold on. I'm going to find it for you so you can see it.
In the interim, I'm curious about how this kind of pickup, which is
it's a pickguard
mounted, or is it?
It's literally, it looks like, it's just like this kind of pickguard, but they cut it with an extra flap, and it's a suspended P90.
So it's suspended, so it's not actually cutting top. So in that case,
No, it's mounted inside the guitar.
Version, right?
We're talking about two different things.
It was like an experiment.
Yeah.
And it didn't sound all that great, to be frank with you. I mean, it was interesting, but you see a few of these. You'll see them on L5s and Super 4s that are pre-war guitars. But I remember Gibson was trying out different types of ideas to how to amplify these at the request of the musicians that were using them. They wanted something that would punch through the sound and so on of a band, and this is one idea that Gibson had, but They came back to it later in a more conventional way with the conventional mountings that we're familiar with, you know.
I'm trying to find, where is that picture of that slanted, like, P90? I'm trying to find that.
I'm looking. Well, it's in the color pictures there. I'll look for you as well. Go ahead.
I'm seeing these other ones with the D'Armont. Well, that's a D'Angelico, but there's some other ones here. I see the one with, like, the Johnny Smith with the humbucker on there. And but that's on an L5. But
look at the Super 400 electric section in the color pictures, and it's just below the one that's wine red. You'll see it. It's a little half picture at the top. It's a blonde Super 400 cutaway with a little slanted P90 mounted in the top there, right in front of the bridge.
There's more other color pictures. Oh, there we go. Ew. Okay, here we go.
Jeff, look at pretty pictures.
Yeah, I was going to say, now he's just he's drooling.
I'll see you guys later. I'm just going
to
stand
here. He's asking to be left alone with the book.
If you look at that page, all the variations on there. You'll see that one. You'll see the McCarty. You'll see the D'Armond. And you'll see the humbuckers up at the top. All different types of ways to amplify these guitars.
You can see there, I'm kind of flashing it on the screen, but you can see all the different ones and the slanted ones down here somewhere, right there.
Really,
so
that book, that Super 400 book, really is a must-have book for
the picture.
Any serious guitar collector. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's,
oh, yeah. No, this is a must. This is definitely a must. But I have a question for James, and that is, how do you like that pickup that you have with that's mounted on the McCarty one? What do you think?
If I was going to complain about it, everybody should punch me in the nose. Like, oh, I have this 59 L5 and I don't like the pickup.
No. I mean, compared to something, because you have, like,
well, no, it's funny with these things that they're really different. Like the guy that sort of set me down the road for archtop guitars is Charlie Christian. That's why I asked him about the blade pickup. ES-150, mm-hmm. middle 30s, that's like the first legitimately mm-hmm. usable electric guitar. And that's why I asked him if there was like a early Super 400 that pickup in it. That's a sound I love, that guitar. And it actually was bolted, suspended inside the guitar. It was a blade pickup from like a lap steel that was screwed in three spots to the top of the guitar. The guitar was laminated. The 150s were. Then they made a 250, which was a spruce top. And I love that sound. That sound makes me crazy. But like I said, yeah, having it a 59 L5 with the McCarty on it, pretty good.
Yeah.
If you can do it, I recommend it highly.
Okay. No, I can't. Well, let's talk a little bit about the tone of the guitar and go ahead and fire up the amp a little bit. Show us on this guitar, the L5 that you have right now. Do you want to kind of demonstrate the West Montgomery sound?
That's what I was thinking. Because in this case, you can't say West Montgomery without thinking L5 or the other way around. And, you know, West was my number one hero back in the day when I first heard that. And that's, I thought, we just again talked to Wolf. I said, when I heard that, I said, I want to do that. And here that was so many years ago, and I still really don't do it. But one of the things that for me, selling Gibson guitars and Heritage guitars and being a player and doing clinics and all the things is you know the guitars. So there's a certain tonality that an L5 has that at the time of this training manual that I have in front of me, they didn't have Heritage guitars, so they said there was not a comparative model. And one of the tones that comes up here is the tonal definition of an L5 in any key or any inversion. And one of the things that Wes did that was really unique was the double octaves on Bump and on Sunset, and I'll just do a bit of it so you could hear the tone, but only these guitars do that.
That is
a certain
cool
tone, and then he would the double octaves. That's it rings. We were talking about the Taiji.
Bring up your individual volumes, just a little, because you're not getting.
I'm all the way up. You hear the clarity, and that high G has a ring to it. It's also noticeable in Road Song on Wes's solo. You hear that high G.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's certain tonalities of it. that turn out just right, and it's still very clear.
Check your connection, because you had a lot more gain.
I sure did.
There's a lot more tone to that guitar.
Yeah, than, I don't, there we go.
I have to turn mine on for him to go, because we're both playing this.
There you go. Almost sounds like one of those pedals that does the octave.
Sacrilege.
That's an interesting sound.
And then, like I said, the high G on the Rhodes song. You hear that?
Definitely got that bloom to it. Now, Greg, give me a little chord melody type of thing, just to show the clarity, how clear it is. Now, let me ask you this. Now, yours is a Venetian cutaway, and that's a Florentine. What's the story on the Florentine?
Well, let me give you a rundown on that. A funny thing happened on the way to the 70s. Gibson actually decided to radically revamp the particular high-end archtops. Mm-hmm. Birdland, Gibson's L5s, Super 400s, and they put Florentine cutaways, which are the deeper, more pronounced cutaways that allow higher access to the fingerboard. And, of course, that gave them a modern look, too. But it was basically a guitar now that could be played in a lot more context than just in the lower positions. So what happened is it became the standard sound and feel of the 60s L5s.
Hold the guitars up, both of them, kind of next to each other, if you can. I want to show people so you can see. Yeah, you can definitely see where the cutaway. Yeah, you have another two frets at least.
Oh, yeah. You can get to the highest fret easily.
That's about
so you can see on the Florentine, it definitely does. It's a deeper
cut. Yeah.
And we have to credit Kenny Burrell for that.
Absolutely.
Because he tried to build one of these in 1958 with the aid of Gibson, and Gibson didn't properly assemble it. It was too heavy because they thought they needed a lot more wood here to support the fingerboard, and it ended up being so heavy it wasn't a pleasant guitar to play, according to Kenny. And so he jettisoned that guitar, and it didn't come into reality until after 1960, when these were official.
When was that prototype?
1958.
Oh,
it was seen in the Newport Jazz Festival when he played with Benny Goodman. There's a couple
of
very famous shots of that guitar.
In that,
and it just weighed a ton.
Actually, it's in the...
it just wasn't comfortable compared to other archtops, so it was too heavy.
Last page of that shows a picture of it. There we
go. So anyway, that was his design, and he was the first one to suggest that an L5 have a Florentine cutaway. And then by 1960, they became normal.
Was it when the Florentine came out, was it just on the L5, or did it go on all those
models? No, it was all the Super 400,
right?
Birdland, and the L5.
And the did the 175 was always a Florentine?
That was always a Florentine.
That was always a Florentine. Okay. And then also, too, I'm not sure that much of a difference. I've seen you on YouTube playing an L4.
Yeah, L4 is 175 scale, 16-inch body, same scale neck, but it has a spruce top, the modern version of it, and an L5 tailpiece, and the fancy bridge probably like his has.
So it has these inlays, this tailpiece, all these appointments, but it's a small, it's a 175 size guitar.
The next right, it's a size, but is the 16. Bracing and the building of it more like an L5 or more like a 175?
175.
Yeah, it's more like
Oh, okay, so it is.
It's still, yeah. still parallel brace, spruce yeah. top, carved top.
Oh, okay, yeah. So it's more like a one, it, the construction's more 175
except for, yeah,
than
except
the...
Has, yeah, a solid top as opposed to a weapon top.
How do you like the and I know this is a tangent, but... Yeah. The difference in tone between that and a 175, is there much?
Basically what happened with this guitar is I had a 60s 175 that got stolen, and the quick replacement to it on the road was getting a, this was the guitar that came up was that was all the things. So mm-hmm. The first one I had was probably like an early 90s one,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, just kind of did all things, because the band I was playing in at the time, it's quite loud, we played with a horn section on things like the Warped Tour. We were competing with punk rock and metal bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was jumping on stage, no sound check at that volume. But I wanted something that if I was playing like chop guitar would still, you know, like just rhythm guitar would still yeah. provide that kind of feel. So yeah, it's an incredible hybrid. I mean, I really have
it's an interesting yeah. guitar. I've never seen one. Or I never saw one of that with the, it's like, wait a minute, is that an L5 or did he just put L5 parts on it? So this is Kenny. When was this?
1958.
This is 1958, so that's the prototype.
More or less, yeah.
Pretty much, that's pretty much what he developed back then that we didn't really see come to fruition yeah. until the mid-60s.
Yeah. Well, actually, the early 60s.
Early 60s.
61.
That, oh, yeah, and he's using the Charlie Christian pickup. You can't see it real well, but he's got the blade.
That's what he preferred.
That's the blade pickup in there.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. That is amazing. I'm going
to
pass this back.
Those of us that might not know and don't have access, a little bit of tonal difference. The blade cuts a little more compared to these. And
to a P90. Yeah, you should compare it to
this. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, they all do a good thing.
Yeah,
like,
no, sure.
You know, like, it's a, you know, it is that thing of, like, listen to Charlie Christian, you'll hear what that blade does. It's a little bit, it's thick and big. It's a very hot pickup, I've always found. It really drives mm-hmm. a tube amp. Like, it will distort more like a P90, but it's also very clear at the same time. It's kind of like, I mean, the neat thing now is that there's actually a bunch of people making really good new ones, so you can have a chance to have one and put it in any guitar. There's guys making them that fit in a pick mm-hmm. guard.
In 1978, they actually made a Charlie Christian ES-175 with the last of those
pickups. I have one of those, too.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
And I have heard he actually put one in a Telecaster, right? That's like a thing.
Yeah, it's a Lawler in a Telecaster.
A Lawler in a Telecaster, yeah.
Which was not necessarily uncommon then, too. A lot of Western swing players electrified. They took them out of steels and put them into Telecasters. Danny Gatton, most notably, was
which also begs the question, kind of like, you know, because the humbuckers would be mid to late 50s and all that, and how do these differ, say, within one we'll find in a similar Les Paul of the time or SG of the time around 60, 61, or are they basically the same pickup?
Same pickup.
They do the same.
They sound really different, in my experience, like when they're in a Les Paul, they do what that thing, they do the Peter Green thing, and as the guitar gets bigger, it's still an amazing sound, yeah. but it's not, you're it does not do the same thing, but they're beautiful sounding pickups no matter what you do.
Let me,
you know, if I can interject about tone just for a second, think about the intimacy you can get out of these guitars with the built-in pickups. The way Wes played with his thumb, or you use your fingers, or even a pick, when you play over that front pickup, you can get the most lush and beautiful sound at low to moderate volume. There's nothing like it. And the L5 is dialed in completely to that sound.
Yeah. Now, have you guys noticed a difference? You were talking about pickups. I've noticed the difference between gold and chrome-plated. They do sound a little different. But I got a question for you, Tom and Wolf. When did the guitars get the tunematics? When did the tunematics come out? Is that all electric, or were there tunematics?
That
on
was
the
in equipment? The '50s.
Yeah,
it was in the mid-50s, I think.
And those were the non-electric ones. Did they use them on the non-electric?
They didn't really use them on non-electrics. I think you could have it if you wanted it, and if you used a DeArmond or something, it gave it a more mechanical response. Most people who use the non-electric preferred the ebony bridges,
right.
like the orchestra players and whatnot,
yeah.
who strummed the guitar like Freddie Green style. But if you
right.
if you had an electric player who had, say, a DeArmond pickup or one of those McCarty aftermarket things, then a lot of times they switch to the tunematic. They were a lot better for soloists, too, because you could really fine-tune them and play everywhere on the
neck. Yeah, well, the intonation, was a, I would think, would be an issue. Yeah. But so the so they would they work better with the electric.
Yeah, one thing I could note to a lot of players should be aware of is there's a difference also in the fact that some tunematics in the '60s, like mine, has the nylon saddles.
Yeah, I have.
It warms it up a little bit.
Yeah, I have an Les Paul, but it's it, people said you're going to lose sustain. You should change it, but it sustains.
I'm sure this sustains fine.
Yeah,
well, all the parts should sustain, and there is some merit to that. But still, there's graphite. I have a couple of graphite saddles on my tunematics. I like the ABR one. That's the original tunematic that Wolf has on his 64 there.
But the graphites are not stock. That's a mod.
They're not stock. It's an upgrade, but it works great. And you know, if you don't want that brass insert like that, that's was after the nylon, they went to brass.
He has Wolf has the plastic, right?
Those are it's the nylon.
Yeah. And then what
this
do you have brass. On? You have the brass.
This one's brass on this.
Okay. And his Super 400 has the nylons.
So. Yeah, because it's a 66. That's still for that period.
Yeah. No, I like them. I haven't had any desire to change them on my Les Paul. That's for sure.
They have a sound all their own. They're made for it. It's all dialed in.
Yeah. Now, the guitars that are made now, and I'm throwing this out at all you guys, the ones that are now, because you can order an L5, it's through the custom shop. Are there any differences? Are they made, or can you ask, because there's so many differences in some of the bracings. If you go into Tom's book, the necks, the way the necks are, the how many ply, the layers, and then also the binding and the shape. Is can you pretty much order any year, or is it different now?
Well, if it's,
you know, they're evolving because they have totally new ownership and new management from the top on down. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. But their emphasis right now is on top quality. I think what we're going to see is a gradual rollout of these fine guitars like these that take a lot more time to make than the Les Pauls do. And they're not as popular, but they're extremely fine. I think we'll see a nice rollout of some standardized features on the L5, the Super 4. Plus, you can order some custom features like a single pickup or maybe a Charlie Christian pickup, things like that. But I think it's still Gibson now is in a work in progress state. But the talk is they're going to be really, really good and real consistent going forward, like they used to be.
Yeah. Well, when I saw at NAMM, the guitars were beautiful. The necks they got the necks right. Now, let me throw this out. We're almost out of time, and I want the guys to play something to take us out on these beautiful guitars. You got to hear them. Real quick, what do you think is the golden year for L5s? Each guy, I know it'll be a different opinion, but I'll start with you, Tom, and then we'll just go around the room.
There's two eras to look at. One, if you're talking acoustic L5s, then I would say in general the pre-war acoustic L5s are probably going to be your best. If you're talking electric L5s, I would say 58 through probably 64 are the ones.
Okay. All right. Wolf?
I completely agree with him. This is a 64. I have a second 64 at home that has the wooden bridge, and they're both excellent instruments. I find that after 64, there's a transitional period that started to happen with Gibson, and they did some experiments like thinning the neck width small. Down and those types of things and messing with the pickups a little bit. They didn't make the PAF style anymore. They made what's called T-tops, and the tone changed a bit.
Okay. Greg?
Well, I have two different versions. My first L5 was a 56 with the Alenico staple pickups. And that was a beautiful sound. And that, oddly enough, came with a Charlie Christian. Not came with, but it had been modified. And I went back to the staple pickup after that. But that was a beautiful guitar, and that had been refretted and refinished at Gibson. So that was a first-rate guitar. Mm-hmm. And that got away. But the other version would have been during the 80s. In the 80s, between about 81 and 83, they were building some of the finest L5s out of that factory. More recent, newer versions.
Okay,
so
that's
I'd
good
say
to know.
Two.
And
well, I think the most iconic guy is Wes, so we're going to go with that PAF 59-61, but I'd also say the staple pickup, also don't forget that Scotty Moore played with Elvis Presley.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if we're going to think of this thing in iconic sense, you know, I was thinking about who are the guys that played all fives, and those were the two guys that I was meeting, like lots and lots of great guys who played it, but I was like, there's two guys you can think of seeing the guitar, the pure aesthetic of it, you know, and the way that they sounded, you know, but yeah, I don't know, but I think even if you have a one from the 70s and you love playing it, congratulations across the board.
Yeah.
You know, like,
Joshua Breakstone plays a 70s model and it sounds fantastic in his hands. Same with Bruce Foreman. He plays a later model. Yeah. And well, they both
well, I think Lee now has a newer one. He has a
Lee Ritenour?
Yeah, he uses a newer one. And
well, he has a signature model.
Yeah, he has a signature model after his original, I think.
I would always say you can't go wrong with a Kalamazoo L5. Yeah. That was my main thing.
And then, amen.
Then we saw some great things come out. As a matter of fact, this one I have here is a Hutch model 92, and it's one of those magic ones. So that's why I have it. But can't go wrong.
Sharon, you want to say something real quick?
I just wanted to not forget that today is a very special day. It is April 1st, and today is the 34th anniversary of Heritage Guitar. That's Orville Gibson's second progeny as far as guitar companies. And the Golden Eagle over here is their version of the L5 for the most part. And then I just want to also just acknowledge that we are in the 125th year since Orville's patent. So Gibson Guitars is celebrating their 125th anniversary this year, as well as this being the 100th anniversary of Orville's death. So I just wanted to make sure that his two progeny got there.
Well, we're out of time. I told you guys it would fly by. And I want to mention Greg. You can check out more what Greg's doing at www.gregdelordo.com. Dr. Tom, you can go to www.vanhoosvintage.com. Got to check out those guitars over there. For Wolf, it's www.wolfmarshall.com, and you can see all the books and all the stuff. And do you have a site?
Well, the best thing that's current is rumproller.com.
Rumproller.com. So check that out.
Hammond B3 Madness. Very, very cool. Some guitar and drums to boot.
All right. I want to thank everybody. This is great. And I look forward to having all you guys on many more times as we do more on these iconic guitars. And also, too, I know you're over in Texas. Dr. Tom, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And this book is great.
Well, absolutely.
Thank you, Jeff, and thanks, guys. We'll say signing off from Station TXAS, Carol, Texas.
What we're going to do is Greg and Wolf are going to play a little bit and take us out. Just go, and I'll just fade you guys out as the show ends. Everybody, thank you so much. Stay tuned. Probably in a couple months, we're going to do another Gibson show, and I think the next one up is going to be the Super 400. So.
Give you an intro.
Everybody, thank you again. Doug, JP, thank you. And we will see you next week. Go ahead, guys.